All right, so let's start. Today I want to talk about some work I did with Ken Ono at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And just for the sake of the seminar, so I'll be talking this week and then Dave Morrison will continue his lecture series next week. All right, so the title of my talk is N equals two supersymmetric gauge theories and what it has to do with Mach theta functions. And the main goal of my talk today is to convince you that this Q series, which can be found in Ramanujan's lost notebook, that this Q series is actually a way of bookkeeping interesting topological gauge invariants for CP2. So I hope at the end of the talk you'll understand why the series is also interesting from a gauge theoretic point of view. Okay, so this is an overview about what I want to talk about today. So first I wanted to tell you a little bit about gauge theory and how we think about gauge invariants, both from the point of view of mathematics and from the point of view of topological quantum field theory in physics. And the latter approach, the physics approach, has the advantage that it outlines an easier way of computing invariants. These gauge invariants, as they were originally formulated, are very hard to compute, but the physics outlined a way, and they argued that the U-plane integral would give an easier way of computing these invariants. That's what I want to explain in the second part. And then in the third part, I really want to talk about the results I got with Ken Ono, which is by putting these two points of views together, you can actually see how to compute the SO3 Donaldson invariants for CP2 using this Mach theta function, and why it's exactly what mathematicians were looking for in the field of gauge theory. All right, if you have questions, feel free to interrupt me at any time. So that's the setup. We are trying, from a mathematical point of view, we are mostly interested in four-dimensional, compact, smooth, simply connected four manifolds with the Riemannian metric. And just because we'll be using it a lot on such a manifold, you have the hot star operator, which maps P forms to 4 minus P forms, and its square on even forms is 1. And the main four-dimensional, compact, smooth, simply connected manifold we'll be interested in is a complex projective 2-space together with its Fubini-Studi metric. And why are we interested in computing invariants for this space? Well, there are two reasons. First of all, it's really the simplest, one of the simplest four-dimensional spaces you can think of where you can get non-trivial invariants. So one side of the story is it's just the simplest. But the other reason is a much deeper reason, which has to do that a lot of four-dimensional manifolds are so-called of simple type. And if they are of simple type, then there's a trick which was figured out by Witten, Mrowka, and Kronheimer, how you can compute these invariants in a much easier way. But for manifolds which are not of simple type, you don't have that trick. And CP2 is one of these invariants which are not of simple type. Okay, I said you have the Fubini-Studi metric.
What is simple type?
Okay, I didn't really say what simple type is. From a physics point of view, you would say that the Donaldson invariants are determined by the Seebeck-Witten invariants, what you expect when you compute the correlation functions. I can try to make the statement a little bit more precise in the end. But I just wanted to point out that picking CP2 is not only because it's such a simple space. Okay, so we have the Kähler metric, which has positive scalar curvature, and its Kähler form generates the second cohomology. Just because I'll be needing it a lot, its Poincaré dual will be denoted by H check. And so, as for CP2, the situation is very simple because you don't have much homology or cohomology. So H1 is 0 because it's simply connected. H3 is 0 by Poincaré duality. H0 is Z, and that's Poincaré dual to H4. And H2 is very simple. It's generated by this form. So situation is as simple as you can imagine. You only have one non-trivial generator in the zeros homology and one in the second homology. Alright, so what do we want to do? We want to use gauge invariance, gauge theory, to study the space. And I just realized that I called the space, I meant CP2 here. Okay, so what do? I consider principal SU2 bundles over this space, and principal SU2 bundles on four-dimensional manifolds are classified by a certain characteristic class. That's the second Chern class. And that's a four form. If you evaluate this four form on the fundamental class of your manifold, you get a number. This number is also called instanton number. And now what do? You consider connections on this principal SU2 bundle, and within these connections, there are the irreducible connections. These are the connections where this SU2 bundle doesn't decompose in the sum of two line bundles which are inverse of each other. Okay, and then the bundle diffeomorphisms act on this principal SU2 bundles as gauge transformations. And I denote the gauge group by this funny G. So here's a form representative for this characteristic class which classifies these principal bundles. It's essentially trace of the gauge curvature squared. And now when we have these connections, we call a connection an anti-self-dual instanton exactly when the following is satisfied: if the connection is irreducible and its gauge curvature satisfies this partial differential equation, which says that the Hodge star of the gauge curvature is minus the gauge curvature itself. Remember, the Hodge star maps two forms to two forms, so this equation actually makes sense. Alright, so this is a very complicated partial differential equation, but it's gauge invariant. So what you can do now is you can look at the space of solutions for this partial differential equation and ask what the properties of this moduli space are. And people have done that, for example Donaldson, and he found out very interesting things. And one of the most important things they found out in the beginning is that this moduli space of solutions, when I fix the instanton number, is actually a smooth-oriented finite-dimensional manifold, and you can actually compute its dimension by an index theorem kind of computation. And for our CP2, you see the dimension will be 8k minus 6, where k is this instanton number I mentioned earlier. All right, so I just defined in mathematical terms what gauge theory on a four-dimensional manifold is, and what do we want to do with this gauge theory. So we want to compute invariants. And there's a construction we need to do first to actually find some interesting invariants. And this construction is called the universal bundle construction. And it goes as follows. So over your manifold X, you have your principal SU2 bundle. And now I take the product, fold it the other way around, with the set of irreducible connections. And now I divide out by the action of the gauge group. And since I've restricted myself to irreducible bundles here, the action of the gauge group is really fixed point free, and this makes actually sense. And it acts, the bundle, the gauge transformation, act trivially on the base space. So what I get as a base space is this. And this object here is called the universal bundle. It has some universal property that you can obtain any other principal SU2 bundle from it. And it also carries a natural connection, and you can compute the curvature of this natural connection. And now this curvature is a two-form on the space space, which is a product of your original manifold and your configuration space. Why do we do that? Well, we do that because from this bundle we can construct interesting gauge invariants. So as I said, this is again a principal SU2 bundle, which means you can again compute one of its characteristic classes, which is called the first Pontryagin class, which is very similar to the second Schön class. I wrote down a form representative of this first Pontryagin class. You see, I take the wedge product of the two form, so that's a four form. I take the trace over the Lie algebra part. So I end up with a four form, but now this four form lives on this product of my manifold and the configuration space. What does this mean? It means I can decompose it in pieces which live in the cohomology of X and in the cohomology of the moduli space. Okay, and now if I take any cycle in my manifold, then I can integrate the part which lives in my manifold over the cycle, and in this way I end up with the form on my moduli space. And I just realized that a part of what I wrote down there was cut off. So let me just write this on the blackboard. So we have this four form which lives in X cross M, where M is the moduli space. And now if I take X equal to CP2, I have two generators in my homology. The one is the generator of my zeros homology. The other one is the generator I mentioned before in my second homology. So if I now do this construction where I integrate the first Pontryagin class of the universal bundle, let's say, over this class, I get a two-form on the moduli space because I'm integrating over a two-cycle, and that is a four-form, so what I'm left with is a two-form on the moduli space. And similarly, I can evaluate this at a point P, and I get a four-form on the moduli space. So right now we have done something which seems really crazy. We started with the manifold and we wanted to find out something more about this manifold. So we constructed this moduli space to solutions of a partial differential equation. That's something really complicated. And now we constructed forms, non-trivial forms, on this moduli space. And we'll use these forms on the moduli space to construct invariants for the four-dimensional manifold we started with. And how do we do that? Well, what you now can do is you can take these forms and multiply them together until you reach a top-dimensional form, and then integrate that over the moduli space, and that gives you a rational number. And this rational number is called the SU2 Donaldson invariance. So you see, if I have a lot of second homology for my four-dimensional manifold, there are lots of invariants I can compute. But for CP2, I only have one generator of degree 2 and one generator of degree 4. So the possibilities I have to write down invariants are very limited. And what people usually do to keep track of these invariants is they kind of arrange them in a generating function. So you have formal variables, and the formal variables tell you the degree of the invariant you are computing. All right, so then people ask you what... Sure.
So what do these invariants tell us in general? Like some...
Sorry, could you say that again?
So intuitively, what do these invariants tell us? Say CP2, for example, you...
That's hard to say. I mean, from a physics point of view, they are correlation functions of some operators in this quantum field theory. So they don't have like intuitive geometric meaning. What they really compute is the structure of the homology ring or cohomology ring of the moduli space. So what you do is, instead of investigating this manifold X, you investigate this much more complicated manifold, the moduli space, and try to figure out what the rational cohomology ring of this manifold looks like. And kind of the Donaldson invariants keep track of the relations in the cohomology ring. All right, and then people ask, now we have a well-defined problem. Now the question would be, well, compute the invariants. And that's actually really hard, even for the simplest example. So the first people who computed them for CP2 for degree less than 50 were Illingswood and Goetscher. And I just listed some of the invariants to give you a feeling of what they look like. So you see, I told you we kind of arrange all the invariants in a generating function. And here you see the first term of the generating function. You see, as I go higher with my instanton number, the dimension of the moduli space grows, and I can pick different combinations of these two classes and evaluate them on the moduli space. Any questions up to this point? Alright, so that's what SU2 gauge theory is on a four-dimensional manifold. And now you can ask the same question, but now instead of considering an SU2 principal bundle, you consider an FO3 principal bundle. And again, you can probably look it up in a geometry book. What are the classifying characteristic classes for these bundles? And again, there's one class which gives you something like the instanton number. And there's another class, the second Stiefel-Whitney class of this bundle, which tells you whether or not this SO3 bundle comes from an SU2 bundle. So let me just tell you very quickly what the story is. Again, you can consider the moduli space of anti-self dual instanton. It's again a finite dimensional smooth oriented manifold. You can compute the dimension. So far, nothing new. Now let's think about what this second Stiefel-Whitney class really detects. If this one is zero, that means that our SO3 principal bundle really came from an SU2 bundle. So there's an underlying SU2 bundle, and you see, then this number here, this classifying number, is essentially four times the instanton number we had before. But we are not really interested in that sort of situation. I mean, I just showed you how, in principle, you can evaluate SO3 Donaldson invariants. So here, you just wouldn't do anything new. So what we are really interested in are SO3 bundles, which do not come from SU2 bundles. And to do that, you know, you see here the classifying number of your bundle is 0 modulo 4, because it's 4 times the instanton number we had before. Now we restrict to the case where this is not 0 modulo 4. So for example, in for the case of CP2, you could have this number here evaluated on CP2. There are two things which can happen. It's either 0 modulo 4 or 3 modulo 4. Sorry, 1 modulo 4. And if this is the case, the bundle comes from an SU2 bundle. And that's the case we are not interested in, because we already discussed it. And in this case, they do not come from SU2 bundle. It's pretty much the same story you know from spin structures, whether your manifold carries a spin structure or only a spin C structure in dimension 4 is detected by some Stiefel-Whitney class. And that's actually exactly what's going on here. Alright, but to understand later what's going on in physics, we are particularly interested in one example, the example I mentioned before, when the bundle is reducible. So what happens when the bundle is reducible? Then our bundle splits into two components. So we have a line bundle and a real oriented trivial bundle. And in this case, the curvature, which takes values in the Lie algebra of SU2, is really only a diagonal matrix, as you can see. And the diagonal part is exactly what describes the first Chern class of your line bundle. And now, I mentioned the obstruction before, that if we want to consider bundles which do not come from SU2 bundles, we have to satisfy a certain obstruction, which was that this number here was 1 modulo 4. And that tells you what kind of line bundles are possible. So in the case where your principal SO3 bundle comes from an SU2 bundle, the first Chern class of your line bundle must be even. In the other case, that it does not come from an SU2 bundle, it must be odd. And this distinction is very important when we go to the physics reinterpretation. All right, and then again, for these SO3 bundles, you can compute these invariants. Again, that's very hard work people did there. So it was first done by Kotchik and Liska in 95. And what you don't see down there is that in 98, Sagier and Goetsche actually came up with a closed formula expression for all these invariants on CP2 in terms of Jacobi theta functions. So it's a very complicated expression, but the expression gives you an explicit formula which for each degree and each combination of your formal variable lets you compute exactly what this number is. Alright, that was what I wanted to say about the math part of gauge theory. Any questions so far? Okay, but the really new development started when physics gave a reinterpretation of gauge theory. And what physics says was the following. So there's an underlying, and I try to explain some of the words I said here. They said there's an underlying twisted n equals 2 supersymmetric topological gauge theory on your manifold, and what you are computing, these invariants, are simply correlation functions of this quantum field theory. I realize that for a mathematician that probably doesn't sound like as if it was getting simpler, but that was actually a very big step in interpreting these invariants from a physics point of view. So in this physics theory, now the connection of my principal bundle, that's what a physicist would call a bosonic field, and there's also another field which is called this the Higgs field, which is a section of a certain bundle over this manifold. Now, something about the words. So, what does the word topological quantum field theory mean? It means that the expectation values I compute in this theory are topological invariants. And how does this happen? So, a quantum theory is defined by its Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian in this theory is essentially this characteristic class we encountered before, plus some other terms which do not contribute, and then the observables in this theory are exactly the cohomology classes on the moduli space we talked about earlier. So evaluating correlation function in this quantum field theory is the same as evaluating top dimensional differential forms on the moduli space. So that this was done by Witten in 1988, and it gave a very nice reinterpretation of the mathematical setup in terms of the physics language. But at this point, this didn't make computing the invariants any easier. So the next step came in 1994, when Seibeck and Witten actually said that, or argued that this moduli space of solutions to this topological quantum field theory I mentioned before consists of two branches. And what that means, they weren't really very precise about that, but the very important consequence of it was that this generating function, which encoded all the invariants, the Donaldson invariants of the four manifold, arises as the sum of two contributions. And supposedly these two contributions are much simpler to compute. So the contribution from the first piece is called Coulomb branch, and the second piece is called the Seibeck-Witten branch. Let me start with the second piece. So the Seibeck-Witten branch is now the moduli space of a different physical theory. But the advantage is that this moduli space is easier to understand than what we originally started with. And in fact, this piece has been given a lot of consideration in the mathematical literature. So the Seibeck-Witten branch is really the moduli space of solutions to what the mathematicians also call the Seibeck-Witten equations. And that space is, that's what they say, simpler to understand than the moduli space we started with. And a point in case would be our complex projective 2 space, because on our complex projective 2 space, our Fubini Studi metric, the standard metric we put on the complex projective 2 space, has positive scalar curvature. And if you know how to work this sort of argument, you use an identity for your curvature and then the maximum principle, and then you can conclude very quickly that for CP2, that whole thing has to vanish. And that already tells you that maybe Seebeck-Witten moduli spaces are better to handle than the moduli spaces of anti-self-dual instantons we started with. Yeah?
Maybe it's not completely ready, but do you know if there are different ways of doing this twist? Because I know that in other cases there are like classifications of the possible twist.
Yeah, so in N equals 2, there's only one twist. There are three, exactly. So I should mention what we are talking about. So you start out with a quantum field theory. And when you write down a quantum field theory, first, it's not something topological. It will depend very much on the metric structure you are writing down. So then physicists, that was invented by Witten, have a way of manipulating that theory so that they come up with a theory which is then topological, which really does not depend on the metric anymore. And this procedure is called twisting your quantum field theory. And for this part of the theory we are considering, there's only one twist. There's a relative of this quantum field theory which plays an important role in the geometric Langlands program, which is called the N equals 4 supersymmetric quantum field theory, and there you have three twists. One is called, I think, the Waffer-Witten twist, the other one is called the geometric Langlands twist, and so on. Alright, so what did I say? So the conclusion so far is, by using this physics interpretation, we can decompose this hard-to-compute generating function for Donaldson invariants into two pieces which are a little bit easier to compute. And for the case of CP2, all of the contributions must come from this piece here. Any questions so far? All right. So what happens on this branch, which is called the Coulomb branch? So I mentioned before that in this theory, the bosonic fields are the connection on your principal bundle, and also a so-called Higgs field, which is a section of the adjoint bundle over this manifold. And in the physics language, you would now say the gauge group, SU2 or SO3, depending on what we are talking about, is broken down to U1 by the Higgs mechanism. What you would say in the math language is what I showed you before: the SU2 or SO3 bundle is reducible, and it's simply the direct sum of a trivial bundle and a line bundle. And so the Coulomb branch now is the moduli space of a theory which has gauge group U1, which means it's an abelian gauge theory, and abelian gauge theories are much simpler to handle. So this is why going from this side of the equation to this side, where you only have the contribution from the Coulomb branch, is such an advantage. Here you are dealing with non-abelian stuff, which is always hard to compute. And here you are dealing with correlation functions of an abelian quantum field theory, which are easier to handle. And what are the moduli which describe this Coulomb branch? Well, first, there's this first Chern class of the line bundle, which I mentioned before, which is either even or odd, depending on whether you started with an SU2 or SO3 bundle. Then there's the minimum, the vacuum expectation value for your scalar field, and then there is a so-called complex gauge coupling. So when you start, you're really describing a family of theories. All of them are described by this parameter, that's a complex number, which is really located in the upper half plane. And the theory you write down is this thing, and you see it consists of two parts. So this is now the Lagrange density for your physical theory, and it has two parts. It has a real part there, and it has an imaginary part here. And you see the imaginary part is essentially some topological invariant, and the real part is the dynamical, the kinetic term for a gauge field and the kinetic term for a scalar field. I said this complex gauge coupling tau should be in the upper half plane, and now you see why, because you always want the sign of these two terms to be positive so that the theory is well defined. And then you see I also wrote divided by a subgroup of SL2Z, gamma 04 is the subgroup of matrices which are upper triangular modulo 4, and this comes from physical consideration that there should be something like a duality group acting which connects different theories for different coupling constants. So for example, give you an example here. The bosonic part of the theory, let's take the obstruction to be zero for now. The first term you read there is really this part over 4 first churn class squared evaluated on CP2 plus other terms. And from a physics point of view, what is only interesting to you is e to the minus s of this theory. So you see now in this expression, if I shift tau by tau plus 4, and remembering that this first churn class is always even, so this number is actually 0 mod 4, this term will stay invariant. It will transform like so I probably forgot a pi here. And this is where the duality groups come from. It just connects different theories which are equivalent, because when you compute physically relevant properties, they don't matter. A shift tau into tau plus 4 cannot be detected by a term which appears in the generating function. Yeah?
Where does the second term come from? It just because you're in a curved background, or it comes from
the twist? Yeah, exactly.
Also, it doesn't come from the twist.
It does.
Oh, it does, okay.
Okay.
It's kind of strange that it's linear F, no? Or that's expression.
I mean, it depends on the degree on the line bundle, which is exactly what I wrote down here. So CP2 is not a spin manifold, so second churn class will be essentially your Kähler form modulo 2. So what I've written down there is really the integral omega wedge FA, which is the same as H check FA, which is something like the degree the line bundle, which is where it comes from. Alright, so now we have the setup, and now there comes a lot of work, technical work we have to do to actually be able to compute this generating function. And let me check on the time. So I'm running really a little bit late on time, so maybe I skip the part how you actually get this piece and just show you the result. And then if you want, I can explain it to you afterwards. So I'll explain. I'm not skipping everything. I'm just showing you the result first. So if you evaluate this piece for CP2, and this was done by Moore and Witten in 97, you get the following integral. It's like a complicated integral. And again, you see we are distinguishing two cases: the case where the principal bundle comes from an SU2 bundle, and the case where the principal bundle does not come from an SU2 bundle. And depending on in which of these cases you are, you get a different contribution to your integral. So either you get the Dedekind eta function to the power of 3, or the Jacobi theta function 4. And I put down the definition here that you want, if you want to see it again. Alright, so now let me just explain one more point about this integral, which might explain to you what all the other stuff is which appears there. So that's something I explained last time. So I explained to you in detail what kind of physical theory we are dealing with on the Coulomb branch. But I actually didn't tell you yet what the Coulomb branch really is. And that's something I explained in detail in my last talk 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago. So let me just give you the upshot of what I mentioned last time in my talk. So what is this Coulomb branch? This one piece of the moduli space which gives us the contributions to the Donaldson invariants, it's a rational elliptic surface over CP1. So you have a base curve CP1, and the fiber at each point is the torus. But you can convince yourself, that's a very simple computation of the Euler characteristic, that if all fibers in this fibration are regular, then you won't get anything interesting. The fibration will just be trivial, torus times your base curve. So you have to have certain curves where this torus degenerates. So for example, it could develop a knot where one of the circles of the torus shrinks to zero. That's called a knot. And then something more drastic can happen, which is called a cusp. And the way to record what's happening to the fibration is what I mentioned last time. So each fiber here can be described in its normal form as solution to the Weierstrass equation. So, and the solutions x, y to this equation, once I've given these polynomials to you, they are polynomials which look like u squared over 12 plus 1/4, or I don't remember what this one is, polynomial of degree 3, where u is a coordinate on the base. So that parameterizes your elliptic curve in the fiber. And one way to detect whether this fiber develops a knot or not is compute is to compute the discriminant, which is this object. And if this goes is equal to zero, you know that you have a singular point in your vibration, that your fiber is is developing a singularity. And last time I showed you for this particular example what the singularities are. So over u equals plus minus 1, the vibration develops a node, which means delta is equal to 0, but g2 and g3 are not. And over u equals infinity, the vibration develops a cusp, which means that both delta and g2 and g3 vanish at a certain degree. And that is the Coulomb branch. This rational elliptic surface is the Coulomb branch, is the moduli space of this abelian gauge theory I mentioned before. And now, I also explained that in detail last time, so I can view this elliptic fiber at each point as the torus which I get by dividing the complex plane by the lattice generated by 1 and tau, or omega and tau omega. So that is the elliptic fiber. And so now I've given you a description of all the relevant quantities which appear in the U-plane integral here. So this tau is the modular parameter of your elliptic curve in each fiber. The delta is the discriminant of your elliptic curve, which you compute like this. The omega is the so-called period of the elliptic fiber. It tells you whether it's shrinking to zero or not, meaning whether you have a node or not. And the u, which is appearing there and there, is the coordinate on the base curve. So the important thing is that coming from this geometric and mathematically well understood object, which is a certain rational elliptic surface, you can write down what this U-plane integral is. And from a physics point of view, this U-plane integral should compute the Donaldson invariance for you. But you see already there's one problem. You see, for example, the omega, which in a way describes the length of the circle of your elliptic curve, appears in the denominator. So at the point where the vibration develops a node, you might get a singularity in your integral, and you have to regularize this integral. This is why I wrote regularized here. But that can be done in a mathematically very precise way. So the upshot is, physics tells you that instead of computing these complicated Donaldson invariants, you should get the same thing by computing this object, which is still complicated but easier to handle in a lot of different ways. And as you can see, I told you this rational elliptic surface develops three singular points at plus minus 1 and infinity. And these are actually the points where the integral gets its major contribution from. In fact, all the other ones are zero. And to evaluate this U-plane integral, this complicated expression, really means evaluating these contributions from the three points where the rational elliptic surface develops singular points. All right, so first to this. So Moore and Witten started doing this for the case W2 equals 0, and they found that, as they expected, this computed exactly the Donaldson invariance of CP2, these complicated rational numbers I gave you in the beginning. But from the formula, I also told you that there were mathematicians who had explicit formula for these rational numbers. And it's really like magic. They wrote down an equation coming from this integral, and it gives you the same numbers as the mathematicians get from their formula, but it's not clear why they are the same. There's no proof why they should be the same for all degrees in P and S. You can just check it to an arbitrary number. It turns out that it's actually true, but you don't know why. Okay, and what Ken and I did was actually we looked at the other case where the bundle does not come from an SU2 bundle. And in this case, again, you can prove the following thing. First, you can prove that the contribution you get from the nodes, from the singular points and plus or minus 1, really vanish. That's really not the hard part. And then the hard part is first to compute what the contribution from the singularity at infinity is, the cusp. And then, as Moore and Witten in this case, we get an expression for our invariance, but we were actually able to prove that this is the same as what the mathematicians got as for the Donaldson invariance for SO3. So, but there's a lot of work involved, and I just want to show you, let me also check on the time, the most important steps, and then you see where the Mach theta function comes in. So, what's the trick when you try to evaluate this integral? The trick is the following. You see all these quantities here, this piece and this piece, are all holomorphic in tau. The only thing which appear which depend on tau bar is this piece here and the imaginary piece of tau in the denominator. So the idea is, so I have something here which only depends on tau, and then I have a piece here which depends on tau bar. What if I could write this piece as a total derivative with respect to tau bar of some function which depends on tau and tau bar? Then I could write this whole term as a total divergence. And then I could do an integration by part and evaluate this integral close to the cusp from where I want to compute the contributions. So the main step in here is actually trying to figure out what the antiderivative, if you want to talk in the language of calculus, of this term is.
Yeah? So is that the main reason why the Z only gets contribution from the singularities? Because you can integrate by parts, and then you only care about some poles or something, or, I mean, some...
Exactly. That's exactly the reason, but there's a slight complication, which is whether you can actually do such an integration by part and patch it together. So, but here in this case, it actually works out very nicely.
Three different patches.
Exactly. So here, this is what I try to write. So we try to evaluate the contributions from the point at u equals to infinity, and we want to do that by writing the term inside the integral as a total divergence. And then doing the integration by part, you see, you only have to integrate, let's say, in the tau variable from 0 to 4. That's just what you get if you do the integration by parts. And that's exactly where the Mach theta function comes in. I tell you in a second what this is. And once you are at this point where you have carried out the integration by part, you can then actually evaluate these coefficients, which should give you the Donaldson invariance. All right, so what about this part Q of t? So here you see that's what we want to do. We want to find a solution to this differential equation, if you want. And so the thing we are starting with on the right-hand side is a modular form of weight 3/2. And we want to write it as a derivative with respect to tau bar. And if you try to do that, you will find out that there are complications. But here's what you can do. You can write it as a sum of two pieces. And the first piece here, which I denoted by q plus tau, is holomorphic, but it doesn't have the right modular transformation under this duality group I mentioned before, gamma 0, 4. It does not have modular properties. To correct for this, you have to add this small correction term, and then together, what I've written in the parentheses, is now a modular form of weight 1/2. But by doing this, you had a price to pay, and the price is exactly, if you want an equation like this to be true, that this actually needs to depend also on tau bar. Or I wrote y is the imaginary part of tau. But in a way, the contribution you get from here is very much under control. So what you want is that if you write down a Fourier series expansion for this term only contains modes, negative Fourier modes, so terms of the form q to the minus n, where q is equal to e to the 2 pi I tau. And the coefficients of each Fourier mode depend on the imaginary part of y, so that when you take the limit, y goes to infinity, everything goes to zero. So actually, let me write it down in more detail. So the q plus part, we expect to look like this. A Fourier expansion in q, where these h alpha are really numbers, and the q minus part is now a Fourier expansion with negative Fourier modes. So in principle, if you only had this piece and tried to take the limit y to infinity, this would blow up. But now the coefficient here depends on y, the imaginary part of tau, in a way that when you take the limit y goes to infinity, the whole thing decays exponentially. This is so this strategy of solving this equation, I think, was originally proposed by Saguier. And it's just a matter of actually constructing this function, and then you will be able to evaluate the U-plane integral. And that's exactly what we did. So I should mention one more point. I said, and then in the end, you actually try to extract the cusp contribution, so you let the imaginary part go to infinity. This is why in the final formula, the q minus will drop out, because all the terms are exponentially suppressed. And then that's the final formula for the Donaldson, SO3 Donaldson invariance, in terms of the Mach theta function. And you see, this function q plus is just a very interesting way of keeping track of all the invariants. Actually, the way we found out about this function in the beginning was that we had all these coefficients, and then having all these coefficients and this formula, we looked at what this function q plus could be. And once we found a candidate, we could actually prove that it was the right one. So here's what the function Q looks like. If I give you a power series expansion, these are the first coefficients, and then you can also compute the power series expansion close to the points where the monopoles become zero. And once you know the series expansion, you can play around with it a little, and you see that up to some terms which look really ugly in terms of Dedekind-Eder functions, which are not that bad, though, this function Q plus we wanted to construct is essentially this function, this Q series function in the lost, which I mentioned in the beginning, in the Ramanujan book. And once you know that, so once you know what the M is, what the Q plus is, then you can actually start to prove that this is actually true. Now the right hand side is computed by our Mach theta function. For the left hand side, we have the formula computed by Goetscher and Sagier, and then you just have to prove some really ugly looking identity for the Mach theta function, and then you know that it's actually true. And as a last remark, I wanted to give you this quote by Freeman Dyson, who always expressed his hope that at some point the machinery of Mach theta functions would actually belong to the, what did he say, to the analytic machinery of mathematical physicists. Okay, thank you. Any questions? That's not the good sign.
What about SU3?
Okay, so in this case,
much harder, no?
Yeah, for lots of reasons. I mean, in principle, so my collaborator, he's a number theorist, and he's like constantly asking me for more complicated cases. So, but the point is that in the case of SU3, the structure of the moduli space changes dramatically, as you know. So then the Coulomb branch looks much more complicated. The other contribution, Where did I write it?
Because there you have these Argyris Douglas. I mean,
exactly.
We're even
in
the
ones
that
and exactly. So here the nice part is only Seibach-Witten contribution and reducible bundles. If you go to higher rank, then there are lots of things which can happen in between these two. So you get contributions in between which look very ugly. But I mean, there are certain very successful attempts of dealing with that, both on the gauge theory side. I know that Kohnheimer has a paper out where he's talking about invariance for higher rank gauge groups. And as you know better than me, there are attempts of describing the Coulomb branch as well. So in principle, you know, maybe it's worth doing.
No, because there are these new particles. I mean, it's really different than SU2 because you have, like, at the same time, an electron and a monopole, so there's no local.
Exactly, but I mean, there are still pieces of the Coulomb branch which you could describe by this sort of method, and maybe that would be interesting. Any more questions?
What's an example of a non-trivial Seibach-Witten branch?
You mean a manifold with?
Yeah, and what would the?
I mean K3.
Okay, so then what's the decomposition that you?
Okay, that's actually very, very interesting. So here you want the Donaldson invariance on the left-hand side, and here you have the Seibach-Witten invariance. So the U-plane must kind of cancel out the Seibach-Witten invariance and give you the Donaldson invariance if this equation is true. Okay. So, and this is exactly what happens. You see, here I said the contribution from these singular points at u plus minus 1 vanish, and the contribution at infinity give you the Donaldson invariance. And for more complicated cases, that's not the case anymore. You will have, in principle, the Donaldson and the Seebeck-Witten invariance would appear from this cusp, from this node of your rational elliptic surface. So the U-plane integral really encodes both of these contributions.
But you mean cusps in more general?
No, I meant like, so the U-plane integral in principle encodes both the Donaldson invariance and the Seebeck-Witten invariance. But for CP2, the Seebeck-Witten invariants are zero, so we didn't get anything interesting from these singular points. But the problem is, if you go to K3, the second homology is much bigger, and you get many more invariants, and the situation gets much more complicated. So this is why it kind of seemed hopeless to me to do anything in a case where this would not be zero, because then you need more homology to work with, but then everything gets more complicated.
Listen, so what did Vafa and Gurin do in a strong cleaning test of this?
So for them, now in this theory, we don't have any hypermultiplets. Now you can include hypermultiplets, and then you get an obstruction bundle over your moduli space. And instead of integrating the first Pontryagin class of your universal bundle, you can integrate the obstruction. And so then you get a partition function. You don't get a generating function anymore. And then things are a little bit simpler. I can actually show you more on these details. It's just...
Oh, so they look at K3 with N equals 4 super angles instead of N equals 2.
And F equals 4, yeah. 4 hypermultiplets. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, like, I don't want you to think I'm cheating here. So... So the Donaldson invariance, I integrate over the moduli space. Let's say in the easiest case, the top dimensional form, something like this. Okay, so the dimension of this thing would be, what did I say? 6k minus 2 or something. And now each you get invariants, and then you arrange the invariants in a generating function. Now, if I include hypermultiplets, the invariants change. What changes is you get an additional class here, the Euler class of your obstruction bundle. And for NF equals 4, this Euler class has exactly the dimension of the modular space. So you don't need any insertion, and all you get are numbers. And you just start arranging these numbers depending on their instanton number in a generating series. You can do the same thing for CP2. We actually did that in our paper. And then this generating function for CP2, in the case NF equals 4, has really strong ties to this Mach theta function I showed you. But this is why the story gets easier if you include more hypermultiplets, because you get less choice in your invariants. More questions? All right. Thanks again for coming.